Good evening. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the first headliners of this new year. Last month, the United Nations sent a special representative to the university to hear 4 hours of moving testimony from the Twin Cities Hmong community regarding the exhumation of hundreds of graves in Thailand. This historic session was the culmination of 3 years of work that included sending a St. Paul delegation to Thailand that was led by Mayor Chris Coleman and petitioning the UN to recognize the desecration of these graves as a serious violation of the cultural and religious rights of the Hmong people. This effort was led by Professor Barbara Fry, director of the university's human rights program. And Barb is with us tonight, and I'd like to ask her to stand. I talked to her. There's Barbara right in front here. Barbara, but we want to recognize your really important work here. Congratulations. Nice to see you. So last month's meeting marked an extraordinary moment when the long arc of history met a story in today's headlines. It was an important, if not painful, reminder that the Hmong were our allies during the Vietnam War, and as a result, they were branded as traitors and they were persecuted. After the war, thousands of Hmong were forced to flee their homes and migrate to the United States. Today, the Twin Cities is home to the largest Hmong population in the country. For this reason, we felt it was particularly important for us to understand this serious human rights violation within the broader context of Hmong cultural history. And fortunately, we have one of this country's preeminent historians of Southeast Asian history right here at the university. My Na Lee was the first Hmong person in the United States to earn a PhD and to teach Hmong history at the university level. She was born in Laos and came to the United States with her family in 1980 after a one-year stay in a refugee camp in Thailand. She attended Carleton College as a Kowloon scholar, graduating in 1994 with a BA in East Asian history, and went on to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She was awarded the Susan B. Anthony Dissertation Fellowship by the American Association of University Women. I bet we have some of those AAUW members here. And she completed her PhD in 2005. In addition to writing about Hmong history, she is the author of numerous works of poetry and fiction. Currently, she serves as Assistant Professor of History and Asian American Studies at the university, where she teaches a groundbreaking course on Hmong history. So please join me in welcoming Professor Mai Na Lee.
Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. It is wonderful to be here, especially because the University of Minnesota has a long history of engaging the Hmong. I don't know if many of you knew that. Engaging the Hmong both as a topic and also as a people, because they started some of the farming programs in the 1980s. And many of the Hmong individuals that sell their products at the farmers market actually got their experiences and training here, you know, in the St. Paul campus. And so that's the first. And then the university also, with the help of Professor Bruce Downing, now retired, hosted several conferences, one of the first national conferences on the Hmong, and published two publications out of that, which still serves today as the foundation of the scholarship on the Hmong. So I'm part of that long tradition, and I'm very happy to be here tonight. Now, tonight I will comment very briefly on an extremely important topic, a topic that touches upon the sacred and the Hmong consciousness. I will only highlight this topic because I'm sure many of you have read about it in the news already. I will not do justice to this topic, but the purpose is only to highlight it, to make it familiar to you, and to encourage all of you to engage in the topic actively and to become, hopefully, political actors like Barbara Fry and Bachia and Yi, who are here engaging the topic on the ground level rather than the academic level. So hopefully When this is a picture of General Ving Pao here. I took of him and his two wives, the two that are still living with him in 2004. And there's many, many myths in the Hmong community about General Ving Pao. So when I was very, you know, much, much younger, probably only about 12 or 13, long before I was ever interested in history or in becoming a historian, my father told me one of the myths associated with General Ving Pao. When General Ving Pao's father died, my father told me years ago, he summoned the best geomancers, Hmong elders of knowledge and wisdom, who knew how to choose the most propitious places for a grave site. Together, these elders led the general through the mountains and the valleys, but each place that they had selected, however, was rejected by General Ving Pao. It was not good enough for his father. Day after day, this group of elderly men led the general through valleys and hills, and each place they selected was rejected day after day by the general. One day, after an exhausting search for the perfect spot as a resting place for the general's father, and not finding this place again, one of the geomancers, a man from the Li clan, my clan, a very powerful clan that dominated the politics in Laos until the rise of General Ving Pao himself in 1960. This man said to the general in a very sarcastic voice, he said, "Ving Pao, every place we picked has been rejected by you. Perhaps you have the ambition of finding a resting place for your father that will allow you not only to walk like an ordinary human being, but to attain the ability of flight like a bird." Rather than getting angry at this overt insult, the general got down on his knees, kowtowed three times to the old man, and he said, "Thank you, elder. May your words of blessing come true." And my father concluded, "From that day on, General Ving Pao never walked again. The moment he woke up, he would step into airplanes, helicopters, cars, and he flew in the sky like a bird." So, you know, I was very intrigued by this story, and I remembered it when my father told me. I have since learned from General Ving Pao himself that this story is apocryphal. But I retell it here tonight because it is extremely significant to our current discussion about grave desecration. General Ving Pao's father died in 1951 when he was, in fact, in military training in southern Laos, far away from the Hmong Mountains in Sien Khuang, in northern Laos. General Ving Pao never attended his father's funeral, let alone led these geomancers to look for a grave site, as the story tells us. Ving Pao was, in fact, several months from completing his officer's training courses when he heard of his father's death. He immediately packed his bags to leave and to perform his duty to his father, he said. But a French officer sat him down and urged him to think seriously about this life-changing decision overnight. "Your father is dead," said this officer. "If you leave the army now, you will not complete your training, and all your efforts so far would have been in vain. If you return home now, there's nothing you can do for your father. But for sure, you will never advance in the ranks." And according to Ving Pao, he cried all night and then returned to his barracks. He completed his military training and became the first and only Hmong in Laos to obtain the rank of Major General in the Lao Royal Army. Ving Pao never saw his father's funeral. He was never there. And yet, right down to the present, even at this very moment, if you go out into the Hmong community to speak with elders, they will tell you the story about how Ving Pao gained prestige, how he rose to become the Hmong leader. So why this is the case can be easily understood within the Hmong's cultural context. And if you, I believe that even Vang Pao himself could not dispute the story, you know, because it's now so popular. And the reason is because, you know, of the cultural context with which the monk perceive personal achievement and personal attainment. For the Hmong people, where you bury your parents have a direct impact upon your own personal success and life. Deep within the Hmong cultural psyche, therefore, Vang Pao must have chosen the perfect resting place for his father. Hence, obtaining the ability to fly, quote unquote. Hmong who hear the story believe the story to be true, and like my father, they repeat the story over and over again as an explanation for Vang Pao's personal achievements. From humble origins, General Vang Pao rose to become leader of the Hmong people, walking alongside kings, prime ministers, and world leaders. And this is exactly what the Hmong aim for their children to achieve in life. For the Hmong, then, his success is seen as intricately tied to the placement in the sanctity of his father's gravesite. Just as a person's success is attributed to the placement of the graves of ancestors, a person or a family's fall from success is also explained with similar stories about the wrong selection of gravesites or the gravesite having been desecrated by people, whether intentionally or accidentally. For now, I want to give the cultural and historical context for understanding the Hmong soul, for understanding the Hmong uproar about what's happened at Wat Thong Krabok. But I'll come back at the end to talk about another very, very famous story concerning a family who did fall from their power position as leaders of the Hmong, precisely because the grave of their father was disturbed. His body was exhumed and his casket was opened. Hmong believe that death is both a physical and metaphysical transition into other stages of being. So this is not the end of our life. We have other lives. Each individual possesses three souls, one that will remain at the gravesite to guard it. And in fact, some Hmong believe that this soul also reincarnates once the contents as well as the coffin in the body in the casket has completely disintegrated or decomposed. The second soul will go and live with the ancestors as worshipped beings. And the third soul is set free at the end of the year in a ceremony called Jopli, or the releasing of the soul ceremony. Once released by this ceremony at the end of the year, this third soul is free to reincarnate immediately into another life form. But each of these souls can only carry out its duty if the funeral ritual is done accurately and appropriately, and if the gravesite and the body remain undisturbed, left to decay and erode naturally over time. And sure enough, inevitably, over centuries, you know, families tend to forget where their ancestors are buried, and they would be less concerned about whether or not the site was disturbed because the body has already eroded, meaning the soul has already reincarnated. Because the soul that guards the gravesite cannot reincarnate until all the contents of the grave have disintegrated, it is taboo to put any non-biodegradable objects or metal objects, which takes a long time to degrade, into the casket. The coffin itself must be constructed with all biodegradable wood, and it must be free of nails. So Hmong coffins are made fitted, you know, without the metal nails. If the rituals are not done correctly, then death is not a stage which the individual merely passes through, but it becomes tantamount to the Christian concept of purgatory. The soul of the deceased becomes stuck. Hence, people whose funerals are not done correctly, or those who died without funerals, as in the case of when fleeing from Laos, you know, during war, for example. The souls of these individuals remain to wander forever, and they constantly bother the families for to be fed, to be propitiated, you know, to have ceremonies done so that they can reincarnate. And so this is the curse that the Hmong people fear, that these souls would remain, you know, and to bother the living. In the early 1980s, when the Hmong first started arriving in large numbers to the U.S., many Hmong men died mysteriously in their sleeps. These sudden deaths were occurring in large enough quantities that it concerned the medical community. And ultimately, there were teams of doctors who were assigned to study the phenomena because the deaths were primarily Hmong men. And so they went and did research, and there was no medical explanation. You know, there was no heart attacks, no heart failure, no strokes, nothing. There's no medical explanation for these deaths. So the way that the Hmong believe and the way that they explain these deaths is to say that these deaths were the result of curses brought on by family members who had died during the war, who did not get the proper burial. They have no grave site. They had no funeral. And so they are now returning to claim the lives of the men. And it is men who suffer, because in Hmong society, men are the ones who maintain these ritual traditions, especially the funeral practice. So pretty much that was their explanation, you know. And the medical community could not come up with a better medical explanation, because they still, to this day, have no idea why these men suddenly died in their sleep. The souls of those who died without proper burial could not achieve the purpose of guarding a tomb, returning to the ancestors, because they never received the instruction about how to return, or to reincarnate into another life. These war deaths brought a curse upon the Hmong community, especially the men who were responsible for maintaining proper funeral practices, hence causing their mysterious sudden deaths in their sleeps. Because souls require food, they constantly demand propitiation and feeding from living family members. Having to constantly do shaman rituals to propitiate and to feed the lost souls of loved ones can become over time extremely costly, and it is a burden upon the family. In addition to the funeral rituals being observed correctly, the Hmong also believe that the physical body is sacred and must remain wholly intact in life as well as in death. Moreover, it must be allowed to decompose in the grave naturally. The body cannot be cremated or disposed of by any other means, because it's not natural to do that. And I should qualify here that when we speak about these traditional beliefs regarding the body, Hmong beliefs in America has changed so dramatically that what I'm saying now would be irrelevant to some Hmong. And this is evidence in the proliferation of cosmetic surgeries that Hmong people have engaged in. So that's evidence that this belief is no longer relevant to the younger generations. In any event, according to Hmong traditional belief, the physical body, to some extent, is believed to also be able to reincarnate with the transmigration of the soul or souls. Hence, if you cut off a leg or an arm in this lifetime, the Hmong fear that the person will be reborn without it in the next life. And in fact, the soul that guards the gravesite would refuse to reincarnate if its body has been violated, if some part of it has been cut off, or if parts have been taken away. Rather, this soul would attempt to retrieve the body parts before reincarnating. The soul, therefore, would haunt family members until they do the necessary shaman rituals to remedy the situation spiritually. Keeping the body intact is the primary reason why Hmong often resist, you know, having doctors do autopsies at the time of death, and why they are very, very uncomfortable with the process of embalming, which is practiced here in America. To avoid the curse of having a spirit of a deceased family member hanging around causing illness, calamity, or mischief, or causing nightmares and sickness, as many of the people who testified, you know, during the grave desecration last month speaks about, you know, some of the family members talked about how they dream of the deceased, you know, asking to be fed, asking for them to lead them home, things like that. So in order to prevent these souls from remaining in this world, in order to encourage them to reincarnate so that they can only become blessings to the families and not curses, the Hmong expend tremendous amounts of time and money to dress the body in the right clothes and to make sure that their loved ones have funerals that are comparable to their status and age. And this is why I feel that this is something that was not understood during the testimonies. When the family talked about how much they expended on the funerals, the clothing, things like that, you know, that was to highlight that the ritual itself is so important that it cannot be repeated. Okay, it cannot be repeated. You can't have two funerals, you know, in Hmong society. To ensure the prosperity of the descendants, a grave site is then carefully chosen by men knowledgeable in feng shui or geomancy. The Hmong choose a site that is propitious and in tune with the force of the universe, if I may borrow that word, force, from Star Wars. And they believe that if they chose the right site that is in tune with the force of the universe, then the family members of the deceased can therefore reap this force to catapult themselves into wealth and success. In success, meaning political, economic, educational success. In Hmong society, therefore, the death ritual is the most important because of the ramifications that are embedded in the concept of the body and in the belief about death and the transmigration of the soul and the body itself into the next life. And appropriately, because the funeral ritual is so important, the ritual songs and practices that accompany the funeral ritual make up the most important bulk of all that is encompassed in Hmong oral literature. Hmong men devote time and effort to commit these rituals and ritual songs to heart. Men who are knowledgeable in these rituals are held in high esteem by society, being regarded at once as having the appeal of a rock star and the divine aura of a religious figure with the ability to speak to the gods and the ancestors. And I'm not joking about the rock star part. At funerals, women fall for them, okay? So they have that appeal. Funerals of elders, and Hmong defined elder as someone who has lived a long life until their hair is, quote, white as onion roots, are taking especially seriously by the whole clan. And note, I say the clan, not just the nuclear family or the extended family. These individuals of long life are considered to be endowed with divine luck, Hmong, which has allowed them to survive all the catastrophes that could befall any mortal beings. And so therefore, because of their divine luck, you know, they're able to live a long life until their hair are bleached white like the roots of onion bulbs. These individuals of long life must be accorded with a funeral that is appropriate to their age as well as their personal status. So the funerals then of very elderly Hmong who are highly accomplished are the most expensive, the most intricate, and the time it takes to perform this funeral ranges from 7 to 13 days. And the ritual itself can involve dozens of ritual masters, cooks, and cultural specialists, and hundreds of honored guests who bear testimony as witnesses that the rituals have been done correctly and in accordance to the deceased's status. Families who fail to celebrate the life of their highly esteemed loved ones will bear the shame among society. People will openly criticize them, and certain distinguished guests, close relatives of the deceased, but from another clan, even have the right to curse the family, or to at least instruct the deceased not to leave any of, you know, his or her luck behind for the descendants. And so because of this, you know, and they would do this by going right up to the casket, and they would say it, you know. So because of this, the Hmong take funerals very seriously. And Hmong funerals are elaborate, expensive, and frankly, exhausting. For the Hmong, and for these reasons, the Hmong graves are considered sacred. The gravesite and its content must be allowed to decompose naturally over time in order for the guardian soul to reincarnate into the next life. Otherwise, it hangs around. Traditionally, the cost of the funeral, as I said, is very high. A family may spend its life savings to make sure the funeral of an elder is done accurately and in accordance to tradition, and they have witnesses, okay? If it's a woman who died, her brother is the witness. If it's a man who dies, his sister is the witness. She's called. And the sister in Hmong society has very powerful position, the mopao. She can curse the clan, you know. So the Hmong fear this curse. They fear criticism from society. And so they must do the right things. All the married sons of the deceased must contribute one cow to be sacrificed to the deceased, and to be cooked as food or distributed as parts to the guest and the ritual specialist. Because only so many cows can be consumed on any given day, funerals can last from 7 to 13 days, as I said. And this is true for especially very, very old and prominent individuals. This is in Laos. The complexities of the extensive funeral dirges that must accompany these rituals also prolong the funeral, so making it last very, very long. The funeral of children is much more simpler. It usually lasts 2 to 3 days because there's not they don't sing the ritual blessing songs. Children, you know, who died in infancy don't have children that needs to be blessed. So it's much more simpler. Throughout the duration of the funeral, the sound of the traditional Hmong bamboo instrument, the keng, and the drum must be unceasing, and the family must feed the guests from day to night. And this is why it can get very expensive. All the animals that are dedicated to the dead are slaughtered and consumed by the guests who are witnesses that the funeral was done correctly and in accordance to tradition. In the U.S., Hmong funerals have been considerably shortened. They usually last from Thursday evening to the following Monday, so from 7 to 13 days to about 4 days, and this is as a result of the working schedule of clan members and relatives and guests. But from the time a person is deceased until he is buried in the ground, the Hmong must maintain constant vigil day and night in their home and at the funeral home. Guests are allowed to come and go as they please, and throughout this period, they express sorrow for the deceased. The family is obligated to feed these guests. Generous family members and some guests often donate food to help defray the expenses of the funeral. Other guests would make much smaller contributions in the amount of $20 to several hundred dollars. And because every time there's a funeral, extensive families come and buy, the Hmong can collect considerable amounts of money to help defray the total cost of the funeral. Depending on when a funeral home is available in the U.S., the vigil can last weeks. And then sometimes funerals are also postponed so that relatives can come from overseas to attend it. Because of the requirement for daily and nightly vigil, from the moment a person dies until the person is buried, the cost of any funeral can be exorbitant. Several funerals within my own family, for example, cost over $40,000. And this does not include the money to purchase the gravesite or the headstone at the cemetery. I've heard of several funerals of very prominent Hmong elders in the Twin Cities that cost over $60,000. These figures highlight the seriousness with which the Hmong attend to their dead and are especially shocking when you consider that nearly 40% of Hmong Americans live at or below the poverty level. So they use their life savings, you know, and it's extremely important to them. Despite the caring for the dead, for thousands of years, grave desecration has been a painful historical reality for the Hmong, a historical phenomena that have impacted the very foundations of Hmong funeral practices. Today, this painful historical phenomena serves as explanation as to why the Hmong construct two types of graves. One is Hmong style, and one is in Chinese style. I have several pictures here, several slides here. This, and I apologize for the quality, but it was very hard to find, you know, a traditional grave. So I xeroxed this from a book about Hmong funeral practices. The Hmong style grave is basically the body is interred, and then there's a pile of dirt, you know, placed on top. And over time, the pile of dirt is allowed to erode naturally. Some Hmong clans and lineages often put leaves or branches on top of this pile of dirt, and others fence in this pile of dirt. But these are all considered Hmong-style graves. The Chinese-style graves is slightly different. It is a mound that is piled with rocks on the top that clearly delineates where the head and the feet are. And if you look at the picture, you can kind of tell, right? The higher part, you know, shows where the head is, and then the lower part shows where the feet of the corpse is. Hmong elders say that when the ancestors of the Hmong lived in China, the Chinese often desecrated their grave sites. The Chinese shared Hmong beliefs about feng shui and geomancy, and they too try to bury their dead in places that are considered lucky or, you know, propitious. And they probably, most likely, have knowledge about Hmong cultural practices and beliefs regarding grave desecration. So whenever they came upon a Hmong grave that is located in a very lucky area, you know, they would desecrate it. They would dig it up. And you're not allowed to touch the pile of dirt at all. Okay, so they would dig it. All that needed to be done was to dig it up, you know, to trample it down. Okay, so that is enough to desecrate the grave and to bring upon a curse, you know, upon the family of the deceased. So to avoid this, to avoid having their ancestors' grave dug up, some Hmong have started to construct graves in the Chinese style, because this is how Chinese construct their graves traditionally. Okay, today, of course, it's different, but traditionally. And they construct the graves in Chinese style in order to hide the true identity of the person buried inside the grave and to prevent it from being disturbed. So if a Han Chinese come upon this type of grave, they would say, okay, it's Chinese, we don't touch it. Hmong elders today refer to these grave desecrations as the most effective means employed by the Han Chinese to eradicate the very foundations of Hmong spiritual and cultural belief. Grave desecration was a destruction carried out against the Hmong psyche and the Hmong soul. In essence, even in death, the Hmong say they found no peace with the Han. Because of the historical precedence of Han Chinese digging up Hmong graves, the fact that that Chinese firms headed the digging of the Hmong graves at Wat Thongkrabok in Thailand was not lost upon the Hmong. Some Hmong feel that even after they had been driven from their homeland and had been forced to migrate into Southeast Asia and ultimately to the West, the Chinese, now in conspiracy with the Thai, continue to follow and oppress them as they've done for thousands of years. Because of the seriousness with which the Hmong regard grave desecration or exhumations of corpse, the Hmong of Laos have only one historical incident that I know of, which talks about a Hmong family desecrating or digging up the family of another individual. This is the only known story of Hmong desecrating the grave of a Hmong. There were extenuating circumstances for doing so, but that did not prevent the family whose ancestor's grave was desecrated from, you know, suffering occurs. Okay, so there is no reason to dig up a grave, for example. This is the point that people talk about when they retell this story. According to the monk, there was a monk leader by the name of Patsy Lau. I don't have a picture of Patsy, but he's the father of this man, you know, Lombleya. The father of Lombleya. Lombleya was monk leader from 1910 to 1935. His father, Patsy, was also an extremely distinguished monk leader. Patsy was a distinguished monk leader in the region of Nong Het, located on the border between Laos and Vietnam. He was very wealthy and had buried all his silver jars in the mountains and crevices around his village. This is before modern banks. Okay, so you know, people had money, they buried somewhere. One day when he was very old, he decided to tell his wife about their location because he feared that he would die and then, you know, these secret locations would be lost to his family forever. And so the old couple set out to find these locations and the old man, Patsy, led his wife and he was smoking a pipe and he, you know, each time they get to a place, he would motion with the pipe over there, you know, by that tree over there by that crevice. That's where I buried this many jars. Unbeknownst to them, when they started out, there was a man, a young man from the Mua clan, okay, from the Mua clan, who had arrived to court women in Patsy's village. But in traditional society, men can't go courting until it's dark, because they're too embarrassed, right? The parents can see them. So he decided that he would hide at the edge of the village and wait until pretty much you know, darkness fall, and then he would go in. But he saw the old couple coming by, and so he surmised accurately what they were doing. So he followed them secretly, and he learned of all the locations of Patsy's jars of silver. Meanwhile, and the old couple didn't know this, you know. So after that, they came back, the young man then took his family, and they went and dug up all of Patsy's silver. Meanwhile, after the old couple had finished their tour that day, they returned home. And on the way home, they met one of Patsy's bodyguards. This was a very trusted bodyguard who had migrated with Patsy from China, in fact. And so the old couple greeted this bodyguard and then they went their separate ways. And it was not until years later that Patsy discovered that his silver had been dug up and had been stolen. And immediately what occurred to his mind was, it must be my bodyguard because I met him, you know, on the way back at the edge of the village. Eventually, Patsy, he was a very powerful man. He maintained a standing army. And so he ordered his soldiers to capture the bodyguard, and he had the bodyguard tortured and, you know, even raped the guy's wife, but the guy would not confess. So ultimately he said, okay, fine, you know, don't kill him, just let him go. And so they let the bodyguard go. The bodyguard held deep grudges against Patsy, but he pretended that everything was fine and dandy, continued to come and work in Patsy's home. And then when several years had passed where nobody would suspect him anymore, he came one night in the cloak of darkness and he shot Patsy dead. So now Patsy is dead. What happened is in a turn of events, the Mua family that had stolen his money somehow ended up marrying to one of Patsy's daughter. And so when all these events transpire, Patsy's son-in-law from that family who had stolen his money was filled with guilt. And he was then suddenly struck with illness. And on his deathbed, he admitted to his wife, to Patsy's daughter, that his family had been the one that stole the jars of silver. Patsy's daughter was grief-stricken. You know, here she is, married to the perpetrators, you know, who had caused the assassination of her father. So she aimed that she's going to die. So she cut a lock of her hair. And when she came to the funeral, she tucked it under Patsy's armpit. And in Hmong society, they believe that if you bury your hair with a dead person, you yourself will die because the dead person's soul will take you, you know, to the ancestors. Well, she didn't die. Her husband died. Eventually, she then was remarried into the Yang clan. She didn't die, but she suffered illness constantly. And so finally, the Yang family summoned a very powerful shaman. And the shaman said, you know, you've done something wrong. You have to admit to us what you've done wrong. So finally, Patsy's daughter admitted what she did. And she, the whole story then about how the Moa clan stole Batsy's wealth and how she was married to the Moa clan and was grief stricken and had cut a lock of her hair and tucked under Batsy's arm came out finally. So the Yang family decided the only way to save her was to retrieve this lock of hair. And so they could not go ask the Low clan, Batsy's clan, to do this because it would be inconceivable. They secretly then organized a team of men and they came up to Batsy's grave at night. They dug it up. And once they took out the casket, the Batsy's coffin was made out of hardwood. So they couldn't pry it open. So ultimately they had to use an axe and chopped it. And in the process, they cut into Batsy's body. And then once they retrieved the lock of hair, it was already daylight. So they didn't have enough time to rebury him. So they ran back home and they left the body exposed. And ultimately, Batsy's family discovered what had happened to his body. And eventually, through various investigations, they realized that it was the Yang clan, you know, the clan that actually was married to Batsy's own daughter. So the two family reconciled. And they had to go and do all the rituals to rebury Batsy and to appease, you know, the soul of Batsy. But Hmong people, when they tell this story, the important point is they use this story as an explanation for why this once powerful family, Batsy and his son, Bliya, has suffered a decline in personal wealth and prestige right down to the present. And after Batsy died, his son succeeded him in becoming Hmong leader. This guy pictured here on the slide. But ultimately, he would be eclipsed. After he died in 1935, he would be eclipsed by Tubi Li Fong of the Li clan. And the Low family was never able to recapture the prestige in the leadership position of their family ever again. So in the context of these stories then, what took place at Wat Thang Krabok is unprecedented in scale. There have been stories about Chinese digging Hmong graves, and this one story that I found in historical records, you know, Hmong oral historical records, that is, about one Hmong family digging up the gravesite of another family. But never before has any kind of grave digging been done to the extent that was done at Wat Thang Krabok. You know, over 900 bodies extracted and dug out of that place and desecrated. And now there's 200 of them that remains in some place, but taken away from their grave sites. So this mass digging is so alien, so abominable, so disturbing to the Hmong psyche that the Hmong have no custom law or rituals to remedy its atrocity. They are at awe as to what should be done and what can be done because they have no cultural vocabularies to grasp or to articulate this phenomenon. Never in their history has that kind of extensive mass digging been done. There have been individual graves desecrated. But the act of taking these bodies out, harvesting these bodies as if they're objects, and for what purpose we don't know, that has never been done in Hmong society and in the Hmong past. And the Hmong today struggle, you know, one of the questions that came up during the testimonies and that the special rapporteur asked the Hmong was, can you give me a motive as to why they're doing this? The Hmong themselves struggle to find a motive for this mass digging because they don't have the vocabulary to articulate this motive. And so, you know, was it done for financial gain? Giving the millions of dollars generated by the museum exhibition of Body World in the last couple of years? I wonder about that. Were there intentions to display, to use these bodies, to manipulate them for that kind of profit? You know, and could Body World have impacted, you know, the decision to dig up these graves? I don't know. These are just questions that I'm tossing out there tonight. During the testimonies held last month, here in the grounds of the university, Prophet seems to be one motive. One man testified that his aged mother's body had been turned to granite. And for those of you who have not been to Wat Thongkrabok,
I have several pictures here.
Wat Thongkrabok, if you look behind the mountains, has a granite mine. You know, these are granite rocks that they mine. So one of the women that was buried there actually turned into granite. Her body, you know, became petrified like granite. And according to the man, he said that when his family members asked the people who were digging up the grave what they were going to do with the body, they said, "Oh, she's a princess. You know, we're going to put her in a museum and we're going to make enough money to last three generations." So perhaps this is one of the motives. But as I said, the monks struggle to put it into their vocabulary because there is no word in their language that could state the motive for what is being done here. Monk belief, in conclusion, focuses both on the physical and metaphysical. For the monk, death is a sacred journey that is not completed until the physical body has fully decomposed, at which time the soul reincarnates to another life and starts the process all over again. The funeral is the most important ritual observed by the Hmong people because it has ramifications for the living. And the body is considered a sacred object that must be left intact until nature works its course. And for this reason, the disturbance of a gravesite or even the disturbance of the mounds, you know, the grounds near the gravesite is highly tabooed by Hmong ritual law. In the Hmong worldview, all beings are both physical and metaphysical beings. Wars carried out against the Hmong are attacks on the physical being. For centuries, the Hmong have proven resilient against these physical attacks, and they have vocabularies to articulate the injustice of such physical violations. Desecrating the graves of their dead and to the extent of what occurred at Wat Thongkrabok, however, is a crime that transcends the physical into the metaphysical or spiritual. It is at once a crime committed against their bodies, especially when the corpses are literally removed, okay, and the flesh are boiled and the bones taken away. And it is a crime against their religion, against their spirit. Although the Hmong have shown stamina over centuries during many wars, they have no vocabularies to express their outrage against what has happened at Wat Thongkrabok. The Hmong say, "Nyo chitawaning tua chitawada." Alive, they are not treated as human beings. Dead, they garner no respect as spirits. In other words, the Hmong have no peace even when they are dead. And that is the conclusion that we all come to as Hmong people in America and around the world today. Thank you.
Whoa, your stories are gripping. I think you had us in rapt attention. Thank you so much. Where should we start? Over here? You have a cherry? Sherry, question right over there.
In many states, there's a lot of law as to how you can bury someone and requires either a crypt or a metal casket, etc. Now, what do the Hmong do here? Because I believe in this state, we need to have a crypt, in which case it would be not compatible with what's going on.
Yeah, the Hmong practices obviously has not been maintained as traditionally. And there has been, as I said, lots of changes to accommodate the modern life in America. For example, you know, shortening it to three or four days, the funeral practice to 3 or 4 days, and rushing it through rather than to do it at a leisurely pace from 7 to 13 days. And so definitely in similar fashions, the Hmong has had to adapt their customs to modern living. You know, and this is not just the funeral ritual, but also other rituals as well. And they do accept when the body arrives at the cemetery, they do, you know, allow it to be placed into another, you know, sort of crypt, as you say, before it is lowered and then buried. Another compromise is that in traditional society, you can't bury two people side by side as you do here in the States, you know, where the plot is, what, 3 meters by six or something. That would violate Hmong belief because that's too close. But they have compromised. You know, they have compromised. And most likely what Hmong people would do, especially for their elders, is to buy two plots rather than one so that they can be placed in the center and farther away from the other, you know, graves next to it. So there has been lots and lots of compromises. Hmong funeral practices have been deeply compromised. And some Hmong Christians use this to argue that we should then all become Christians because now we all, you know, do our funeral rituals in the same home now, you know. So each clan traditionally, and there's different lineages within the clan, you know, each lineage have taboos about doing funeral rituals of other people in their house. So in other words, you know, you have to be closely related in order for you to do the funeral ritual inside your house. And they do it at home, and then they take the body to be buried. And that's already been compromised because you can't do that here in the States. You have to have a funeral in a funeral home. And so now all different clans use the same funeral homes in St. Paul, right? So it's either the metro, the Moa Funeral Home Metro, or one of Vang Pao's, you know, General Vang Pao's legacy funeral home, or, you know, so they really have changed dramatically the ways in which they practice these rituals. As I say this, you know, there might be questions about why is this acceptable to the Hmong? The Hmong understand that they have to modify certain rituals to fit with the times. And they have been doing that over the centuries. So in other words, the rituals are not rigid, okay? But the change has to be gradual. The change has to be voluntary. It can't be something, you know, that is a violation of their beliefs. And when it becomes a violation of their belief, then, you know, they see it as something that's wrong.
Right, now we have another question on the left side over here.
Have the mysterious deaths of the male Hmongs decreased?
As far as I know, they occurred very high in the 80s, and then they sort of died out in the 90s. I myself have not heard of any sudden death, for example, in 2000. You know, so it has decreased over time. And, you know, that some Hmong elders explained that because as the Hmong came to America, they're able to establish themselves and have the money, then they have done a lot of the rituals, the soul-releasing rituals especially, that release the souls of their dead, the war casualties. And so as a result, over time, you know, these souls are slowly being released, and what's done to them has slowly been remedied over time. So they use that as an explanation, some of the elders, when you speak to them. But, yeah, it has decreased over time.
Question up front here.
As a Christian, we use the concept of forgiveness, but I heard you say the two clans reconciled. Is that a way of settling differences before it goes to the grave, or can there be reconciliation after someone goes to the grave?
I'm not sure I understand. Like, during the funeral ritual, or what, or specifically this incident that you're referring to?
Well, I heard you say about the clans reconciling, the
right.
Two different, one married the brother of the other.
Right.
And my head isn't accustomed to the concepts I'm learning from you. So can they reconcile families if somebody's gone to the grave already? Can the people that are left behind reconcile, or does that have to stay with them until they get into another life?
Yeah, reconciliation is an acceptable process in Hmong society. I'm not exactly sure that it's comparable to the Christian concept of forgiveness. You know, because in Hmong society, reconciliation has to occur pretty much on the material level. Okay, so for example, during the digging of Patsy's grave, the Yangs had to pretty much come up with the money and the animals to be sacrificed to make the situation go away. And so therefore the two clans then reconciled in that way. They made an agreement about what the responsibility of the Yangs would be since they've committed this act. But whether or not, you know, the act has been forgiven is another question. And definitely, Hmong people believe that the Lo family has been cursed forever, you know, until the very, you know, present as a result of this situation. So it is not something that's going to go away just because you remedy the situation. It is always going to be there. And so the reconciliation does not mean that you're going to remove the curse or that it's gone, you know, but it has serious ramifications for the family, which they will have to endure, you know, according to the Hmong traditional belief, and that they still endure right up to the present.
Could I ask, what's the time frame in which this desecration has been occurring? Is it still going on, and what's the UN trying to do about it?
At the Wat Tham Krabok in Thailand?
Yes.
The Thailand, I believe it was Yi and Barbara can probably speak better to this question because they work directly with at the Wat in the Thai government. I believe too it was right after the Hmong, a mass immigration of the Hmong had occurred in 2004, and because lots of family had left, you know, then this opens the door for these graves to be dug up because the Thai government said, well, they're no longer, nobody could claim them now, you know. So I think it follows after the 2004, and I think Yi, you know.
Sure. If you remember, in 2004, Minnesota received about 5,000 of the 15,000 refugees from this refugee camp in Thailand, Wat Thong Krabok, and that was 2004. And it was immediately after the resettlement process started that the people, the authorities and the abbot and the foundation that was responsible for this refugee camp decided that they were going to exhume the bodies because knowing that within a year the people would have all left. Therefore, there would not be anybody left. And so I think they felt that they were just clearing their land of graves. And what they have done was they have put out a ad in the newspaper, basically, that says we're looking for people to come and dig up, remove some graves from our lot, our land. And the people that responded to their ad was these two religious organizations in Thailand, pretty prominent organizations in Thailand, whose job it is to remove graves that are unclaimed and unidentified and otherwise not recognizable by, you know, by anybody. And that's what they were told by the authorities at the Wat Thong Krabok. And so they were basically given permission to come in and to remove these graves as they wish, as they see fit, as they saw fit. So the time frame that they started the grave desecration was, the exhumation was in October of 2005 until mid-December of 2005. And the family members who many of whom have already come to Minnesota did not witness the exhumations themselves, but there were still relatives there who were able to take pictures and take videos of the exhumations. And that's why we were able to get a lot of the actual evidence of the exhumations and live footages. But it happened, you know, a couple of months, and it involved hundreds of people. And it was a huge operation. If you see the videos, some of the videos are online, and we have a lot of videos at the university's human rights department. But it involves hundreds of people, 200-300 volunteers a day, every day, for those couple of months, to carefully exhume each of the graves and And like Mana was saying, you know, kind of harvesting them in that way, using that word, because they did it in a very meticulous way, very carefully, as if they were going to use the bones for something else. And I was part of the delegation with the mayor that went to Thailand to talk to some of these organizations and talk to the abbot of that temple, and they made it pretty clear what their intent was. You know, one of which is that they just want to get rid of the graves because they're going to use the land for something else. And then the other explanations that they gave was that the Hmong graves that were there were contaminating the local water source, and that's why they were removing it. And then they gave other explanations as to why they were. So, you know, the explanations kind of, weren't very definite. Because we got different answers from different people when we were there.
Would you tell the audience who you are?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Yi Chang, and I've been working with Professor Barbara Fry and a lot of the community members who are victims of this grave exhumation, and have been doing a lot of work with some of the local elected officials to make sure that this issue gets heard on the local and state and federal level, and making sure that this issue is also heard on the international level with the UN and what they can do to help the families find a resolution to this issue.
What other questions might you have out there? Here we go, Margie.
Right here. So while you're raising all of this awareness, what are the Hmong families doing? I mean, are they living in fear that there's going to be this great plague or something that's going to come upon them as a people? And how are they dealing with that?
There seems to be that indication during the personal testimonies that these families are suffering psychologically. You know, that it's psychologically traumatic for them. The stories about, you know, their dead coming back in dreams to ask, you know, them why they don't love them anymore, coming back in dreams to say, you know, where's my home? You know, why have you abandoned me? You need to lead me home. And so, you know, the whether or not you buy into Hmong traditional belief, there's a clear indication that it has deep psychological trauma for the families involved. And especially because now they don't know where the bodies are. You know, I mean, there's 200 of them that are left, but the rest, you know, are gone. They have no idea where it is. And so they seem to appear very emotional, you know, during their testimonies. I myself don't work directly with them. Again, Yi and Bachia and Barbara are the people who work directly with them. But that was the indication I got at the testimonies, that they're afraid that these will have ramifications for their family. And one guy talked about how all his children, it was his child that had died and whose grave had been desecrated. And this child keeps coming back in nightmares to the other siblings, you know. And now all his children are sick one after another. And, you know, he has to do one ceremony after another to cure these children. And so he talks about that. And so pretty much it will be an expensive task, you know, if the situation is not remedied in a way that these people feel psychologically at peace with what's happened. Because they will continue to be haunted, and they will continue to have to perform shaman rituals and other rituals to make themselves feel better, you know, to appease the spirits that they feel are hunting them. So these could be very expensive tasks. And I know one of the questions, you know, that probably the UN rapporteur and other people are saying, you know, they say, what do you want? You know, what do you want us to do now that it's already happened? You know, it would be very hard for a Hmong person to, and we think in our society, our society of lawsuits, we think of financial compensation, right? But how can you calculate the financial compensation of an emotional or psychological distress? You know, what amount of money would be enough to perform the rituals that's necessary, you know, to make these spirits go away in the minds of the victims, the surviving victims? So if you ask a Hmong family, what amount of money I doubt very much that they will give you a number. Because we're not talking about just this generation. We're talking about generations to come. Pretty much like Batsi Lau and the Lau family, you know, who are still suffering the psychological consequences of their ancestor having been dug up by the Yang clan. So, you know, does our law address the next generation of people who are going to suffer, you know? We don't in our society, right? And so how can a Hmong family, you know, be expected to get up and state an amount? They can't. You know, they can't. It would be, you know, to infinity. Okay? That's pretty much. Because every time when they have a dream or something, they would have to do something. Okay? And that goes on for generation to generation. So when I was in Laos in March, you know, for example, Pati's family, I interviewed the grandsons and great-grandsons, still talks about dreaming about the incident and dreaming about Batsi coming to ask them to remedy this, remedy that. And we're talking 3-4 generations removed. The incident with Batsi happened in the 1850s. You know, and this is 2001, 2008. And they're still, you know, they're still thinking about it in that terms. So there is no way that a Hmong family can come up and name a financial price for, you know, what's been done. They can't. They don't have that number in their vocabulary, you know.
Why don't we have another question in the back here. Kathleen.
I've got two questions. Well, they're not exactly related, but the first one has to do with you mentioned here in the Twin Cities that 40% of the Hmong population is living below the poverty level. How does a family then deal with this expensive funeral if they are poverty stricken?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they you know, about the estimates, the census 2000 estimates that about 36% of the Hmong in the U.S. live at or below the poverty level, you know. And it doesn't matter if you're poor or rich. It's an obligation that has to be carried out. And the Hmong community is very good, as I said, in terms of contributions. So they have systems within their own clans where the whole clan would contribute something, you know, and so they have that kind of system. Or if they have a church, you know, they could get the church, the whole church to contribute something. And so the cost is defrayed, you know, to the community and not just the individual family, especially in America. Not so much the case in Laos, but especially in America, where you get very costly. Every guest that comes usually will contribute amounts of $20, you know, to $200. And there's a ritual to the contribution. When a person comes and gives money, the men of the family of the deceased have to thank them ritually, you know, so to show respect and honor. And so, you know, they're very good about helping out. The amounts of money that are collected, like, I'll give one example of my family member whose funeral cost a little bit over $40,000, not including the cemetery plot and the headstone. You know, if you include that, it would be over nearly 60. The contributions from the extended clan, the families, the guests, pretty much defrayed about 50% of that cost. And so then leaving about $20,000 to be spread to the sons and daughters of the family, you know. So that's how the cost was defrayed. So over time then, individually at the nuclear family level, each of the sons contributed about $3,000-$4,000, and thank God, you know, this relative had many sons. So he had 7 sons. So, you know, divide 20 by 7, you know, it gets much more affordable.
And you had another question?
Yeah.
And the right in the middle.
Other question is it has to do with Thailand and the land where these graves have been robbed and desecrated. Is anything going on with that land right now? And what did those organizations say they were going to do with the land? And are they doing anything with it? Or what's happening there?
Yeah, I mean, during the testimony, I think it was you or somebody said that they had plans to develop the land. They were planning to build, what was it, Yi?
Well, right now, we don't know what they're doing with the land, but when we were there, they had told us that they had plans. First, they told us that they had planned to develop the land to plant some herbs. You know, this is a very famous Buddhist temple in Thailand. If you are a rock star from England, or if you're a Hollywood actor from California, and you are addicted to drugs, this is kind of where you go. This is a well-known place in Thailand to a drug rehabilitation center in Thailand, very revered by the Thai government, and it offers a sanctuary for Hmong refugees. And so they're doing a lot of things at this temple, this Buddhist monastery. So what they told us is that they have plans to, you know, to expand their facility, have plans to build on it, develop it, maybe plant some herbs to help with their programs, the drug treatment programs. That's just one explanation. But when we were there, they didn't do any, you know, it was overgrown. A lot of the places where the refugees had lived before were overgrown. The cemetery where all the bodies were disinterred were overgrown. And I think part of the reason why they were left untouched when we were there was because of the international pressure that's been put on them and the spotlight that's been put on them. And so they haven't done anything with it when we were there. I think part of it is because of this case being heard in the U.S. and it's now going to be heard at the U.N., and so I think they're very careful about what steps they're going to take regarding the land. I just wanted to say a word about the cost of funerals. You also have to remember that it could get expensive, but you think about the average American funeral that lasts maybe an afternoon or a day or two. And it costs, I think I last read that the cost of an average American funeral is about $10,000. And so when a Hmong funeral that lasts 4 days, 24 hours a day, costs $40,000, I don't think it's that much more. And so I think part of it is like what Maina said is that there's an extensive network in the Hmong community where funerals are such an important part of life that it amounts to a community gathering, and it's a place where people come and celebrate life. It's not what you would think. You and I would think of a funeral. When you go to a Hmong funeral, it's a celebration of that person's life, and everybody in the community is there, and you don't have to be invited to go. In fact, if you're anybody in the community, that's where you see people, is at the funeral home. It's Hmong funerals that are elaborate, rich part of our culture, especially here in the Twin Cities. It's vibrant, and it's much more vibrant than it was probably ever was traditionally. But I think a lot of the cultures and rituals are much more enhanced, and because people have money, people have resources to make sure that all those rituals are followed, and so. There's so much richness in the culture, and I think when you see something like this happening to the culture or the religion of the Hmong people in places like Thailand, it hits home so hard. It's because we celebrate it here every weekend in the community, and you know, and so this type of violation really hits home to every Hmong, not just here in Minnesota, but across this country, and in fact across the world. Where Hmong people are. And so I just want to add that little note.
Thank you. We probably have time for one more question. Or Barbara,
yes. Is the Hmong community elders, are they doing anything proactive to help the community heal over this trauma?
The Hmong have an extensive network. And as I said, and as Yi said, during funerals, they gather together. You know, funerals are the time when the only time when Hmong will move beyond their own clan to help out another individual. They don't do that so much. The other important ritual is the marriage ritual, right? They don't do that so much. But the funeral, you know, they do it. And so I think, but on the other hand, the funeral is very individual. It only members, not even the clan, but clans are divided into lineages. Only members of the lineage can decide what needs to be done in order to, you know, appease their own psychological well-being or to appease their spirits. That itself has to be done at the lineage level, okay? It can't be done at the community level. And so each of the surviving victims, you know, the families within their own lineages, they themselves have to address the ramifications of what happened in Wat Takambak. The Hmong community cannot, as a group, gather and do one big ritual to do, you know, it doesn't occur that way because of the nature of the way that the funeral rituals are observed in Hmong society, which is very individual within the lineages. And others come and help out financially, but they don't make the decisions about how it should be done, when it should be done. That decision is left to the members of the lineage within the clan. So it's going to be hard to address it at the community level, you know, especially this kinds of thing. And I don't think it has been addressed at the community level, other than different, you know, families gathering together to raise consciousness, to form and to rally some sort of movement, you know, to stop what's happening. Other than that, the rituals themselves are done at the individual family levels only.
Thank you. Let's hear from Barbara Fry again, the director of the university's Human Rights Center.
Thanks. Thanks, Myna, for a really interesting presentation. I appreciate your attention to this. I just wanted, before we close, I wanted to have the chance to interrogate you a little bit further on the motives question.
Sure.
And I want you to talk about the connection between discrimination, really your last quote, the discrimination against the Hmong people in Southeast Asia and this kind of desecration against Hmong graves, not just at Wat Takambak, but the historical desecration that you've been talking about, and what the connection is between discrimination against the living and desecration of the dead.
Right, right. What does not come out is that the situation of the Hmong in Thailand in particular is very tenuous. There's lots and lots of human rights violation against the Hmong in Thailand that have never been addressed in the past. And in fact, before the grave desecrations of the Hmong at this Wat Takambak in Thailand, there was an incident that stirred some of the Hmong human rights group to move in on Thailand. And I don't know what the result of that is. But there was one incident where the Thai, supposedly Thai police, and Thai villagers nearby just came and chopped down a Hmong orchard of fruits, a Hmong fruit orchard. You know, and the loss to the Hmong was probably in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. But we're talking about huge acres of fruits. They felt that the Hmong didn't belong there. They didn't have the right to use the land. Although the Hmong, these are Hmong Thai. These are not the Hmong refugees from Laos. These are Hmong Thai who have been in Thailand since the 19th century. And their land, they have deeds to their land, you know. So, and yet, look how the Thai government and representatives of the Thai government, and look how individual Thais in nearby villages treated them. So the question is, how then does that transfer to the Hmong refugees from Laos if the Hmong Thai themselves are not perceived as Thai citizens, as belonging to Thailand? Well, the Hmong from Laos are basic pariahs. They have no rights in Thailand, even though they enter the country legally as political refugees. And so what's been done, you know, I think that one of the questions that the special rapporteur asked, which, you know, was not, you know, could the Hmong could not answer, was, you know, what would you want? Okay, that was one of the questions out of this. And why should he care? This happened way across the globe, you know. in some distant place. And I guess for me, you know, the answer would be because human beings, we happen to be that unique species on the planet that, you know, buys into the philosophy that man does not live by bread alone. Okay, so we're not a species that just deal with the physical. We deal with the spiritual, the imagined, you know, and our identities transcend the physical into the spiritual and into the imagined. And so therefore, these kinds of act may be physical. It may seem small in scale, but it transgresses upon the spiritual, upon what it means to be a monk. You know, what it means to be a monk. So if for example, during the war, right, about 25% of the monk population perished. You know, about 25% of the population perished during the war. That we can understand more easily, right? Because it's physical. If you shoot somebody down the street, you know, you can see the blood, you can understand. But when an act also has a spiritual or psychological impact, and we don't see the physical part as being that significant, and we ignore that psychological impact, it can have ramifications toward how the Thai government and how the Thai people themselves will be treating the Hmong in Thailand in the future. So in terms of human rights, in terms of basic rights, you know, to make a living, to live as human beings, it will have ramifications, you know. I think that if the Thai government is allowed to just do this without some sort of action, you know, to redress what they have done, then the next step is, you know, pretty much that's how the Holocaust started, right? You know, that's the next step. And so this is why the Hmong fear that they have to do something. It may be an act that is not seen as significant. Sure, okay, around 900 bodies were exhumed. They're dead anyways, you know. But the psychological implications of that, the fact that this act transgresses a Hmong religious cultural belief, it destroys the Hmong soul. That's how genocides and Holocausts happen in our human society. It starts with that, that disrespect of the spiritual and the intangible things that we cannot touch. And so it has huge ramifications. And this is why the Hmong are in uproar about what's going to happen, because this act has an impact on how the Hmong will be treated in Thailand. And there are still over 120,000 Hmong individuals, both Hmong Thai and Hmong refugees from Laos, population over 120,000 in Thailand. You know, and so, you know, if we don't do something now, if we don't raise, you know, the consciousness of what could happen, then the next thing would be, you know, I think individuals would be free to just shoot Hmong people down the street or something, you know. So it has ramifications beyond, you know, just what's happened at Wat Thongkrabok. And I think that's what worries the Hmong the most at the global level. And then other Hmong in other countries have their own discrimination issues that they're dealing with, right? Too. And so they're worried that if one government is allowed to get away with this kind of act, then the next one will be, you know, allowed to do the same, and then the next. And Hmong would not be able to have their rights. They would not be able to practice their rights as human beings around the globe. So it would have ramifications even beyond Thailand, into Laos, into Burma, into China, you know, where the Hmong population still are, and into the West. And so this is the fear, and this is the reason why they feel that it has to be, this act has to be recognized and remedied.
Myna, I think you have helped us all learn so much tonight, and you've certainly answered the question of why should it matter to us. So I thank you very much. Thank you all for being here, and appreciate the additional input from your expert friends here. And Barbara, nice to see you again.
Thank you very much, Mina. We're very proud to have you on the faculty here.
Thank you so much for coming.